Dirty Moderates, few debates have become as fraught and contentious as the debate, not only over trans rights, but over what's been known as gender-affirming care, puberty blockers, and the anatomical changes that people under 18 have been making to their bodies in the name of identity. It's not an easy issue. It's an issue which has rocked the political world, often gets caught up between good and bad faith and awful faith debates about who people should be, how they should be, and what laws should be passed in response to those. However, there is a middle ground, as Dirty Moderate prides itself on, and it's worth exploring what are some of the real concerns about what kids are doing to themselves, what choices parents have, and what it means to be trans or to be non-binary or to really question yourself and then how to handle it. My guest today is Stella O'Malley. Stella is an Irish psychotherapist who had her own intense experience with gender as a child, and the resolution of that gender distress made her very curious about the wisdom of early intervention. She has presented documentaries on this in 2018. She did one in the UK called Trans Kids, It's Time to Talk. In addition, she facilitates a parent coaching site that offers practical and pragmatic help to parents who are navigating these very rocky shoals. She is the director of something called GenSpect, an international organization that offers a healthy approach to sex and gender. Today, though, we're going to talk a lot about her book, her recent book in 2023 called When Kids Say They're Trans. It's a work which explicitly encourages parents not to immediately consider gender-affirming surgery or other medical procedures that might prove irreversible. Stella co-wrote this with her colleagues, and she argues that only parents really know best. And their book, the book, by the way, is co-written by Sasha Ayad and Lisa Marciano. They all hope that parents make these real life decisions with care and with the knowledge needed to both support their children's identity, but also help them be who they are. I'm really happy to welcome Stella O'Malley and to discuss this current conversation over science that is far from settled, but a debate which rages on. Stella O'Malley, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. Great to have discussions about this difficult issue, but very important to discuss
Difficult issue. I think I want to start with what I was saying to you before we went on the air, is that the debate over trans issues and gender-affirming surgery, and there's so much jargon here, so I'm just using it to spitball for a second, is become one of these insane conversations, right, that is plagued by not just misinformation and censorship and ill will, but the debate seems to fall along. You're either a good faith person and you're pro-trans, or you are a bad faith, evil person, and you are transphobic. And as in life, those binaries are not true. They're not helpful. They, as I always say on this program, most things tend to generate, you know, more heat than light. And so I want to have you want to talk in the most general sense, and of course about your book, which I loved, When Kids Say They're Trans, about, you know, this really serious inflection point. And the best thing before you dive in, I want to remind listeners here, is we have good faith debates here at Dirty Moderate. We welcome everybody to the program because we believe, let's hear the ideas. Let's discuss them. Let's not shut them down, especially with something like this, which is far from settled. So Stella, welcome to the show. I just thought we'd like jump off that point and then take it from there.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary swerve in global politics that, of all things, trans issues has become a really hot button topic. It never has been before. And the way it has been kind of almost owned by the left and rejected by the right is also a swerve that I don't think any of us would have expected. Like if somebody had said 10 years ago, this is going to be the divide between left and right, and it's going to be a hot divide, people would have said, really? Left and right? Trans and where is that? So it's an extraordinary, it's come in like a rocket. It's come in like a rocket in terms of numbers. And before, let's say, about 2012, 2014, there really, like, as far as the numbers of people who were medicalizing and transitioning were tiny. So it was kind of a very small group of people with a small group of clinicians, tiny levels of research, and frankly, not very much interest in from the world. Then what happened was an extraordinary explosion happened, and it happened with a never before seen cohort. So before that, there'd been two main cohorts, which was middle-aged men and very young children. And I, as you described in the intro, I had my own experience as a very young child. I was classic, if you follow me, classic childhood onset gender dysphoria. And the other cohort is the middle-aged men. And then somewhere out of kind of nowhere, one could argue, some people would disagree with me, but teenagers started to presenting to clinics and they'd never been seen before. This was never a cohort that had been seen before.
What year did this start again? I missed that.
It shot up at about 2014, about 10 years ago. Yeah, about 10 years ago. You know, it was slightly, it was definitely rising from about 2011, 2012, but it really started to gain ground. About 2014, it started to really start to rocket. And then by 2018, it was just all among adolescents, never before seen. So we didn't have any research on adolescents because no adolescent, there'd never been adolescent onset. There's obviously, there's always a few exceptions that make the rule, but they were not a cohort. So there was no generalized research you could have on adolescents. And the big difference is suddenly parents wanted to know about trans. You know what I mean? Because obviously these are parents of adolescents. And the level of comorbidities among these adolescents happens to be very high. So a lot of these adolescents would have other challenges. For example, most commonly autism, but not only autism, ADHD, eating disorders, OCD, anxiety, depression. And I know, because I love the idea of good faith arguments, and I really like to kind of test anything I say. And I know people on kind of a different kind of understanding of gender that I would have, they would say, these people never were able to present before. They never felt confident enough to present before. And society had basically finally been open to trans issues. And that's why they presented. But it still seems to me to be unusual that we saw even in fiction, we saw childhood onset gender dysphoria. We didn't see adolescent onset. So it's a kind of an unusual phenomenon that happened very, very fast.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to extract from your book with a kind of central question, and it really is a handbook too. I mean, it's a really well-researched, well-argued book because it really helps. I'm not a parent, but for parents who support their kids too, again, for those listening, this is not some kind of screed. This is not a piece of tendentious bullshit like people write and without really considering nuance in the issue, and the issue demands nuance, and it's not getting it. But one of the cornerstone, I think, of the book, seeks to answer or puts at the center a life strategy, right? What purposes do trans identification and transitions serve, right?
Very good.
The answers that you guys give, you and your colleagues Marciano and Ayad, to kind of bring the conflict over gender to a different kind of space, right? Where it hopefully can certainly be discussed, if not resolved, by supporting a young person's move toward a healthy identity, not by transitioning or changing, but by individuating. In other words, not making the crossroads of that teen's experience gender transitioning, but letting them be who they are and deciding that before they make any real substantial changes in their life. Wouldn't you agree with that? I think that's the, wouldn't you think that kind of hyper-focuses your argument?
Yeah, that encapsulates what we are promoting in our book. The book that we wrote it as a result of all of us work in the field. You know, I run Jen Specht, and Sasha Ayad sees a lot of the adolescents, and Lisa Marciano sees a lot of detransitioners and parents. So we all work in the field, and we got to know each other because we became so overwhelmed by emails from people seeking us. And there was no physical way we could see them all. There's not a chance, not even a, Sasha Ayad's waiting list, my waiting list. It's ridiculous. So when your waiting list becomes ridiculous, and when you close your waiting list, and I closed my waiting list a long time ago, and you open it and then you immediately close it again, you realize something needs to happen because we're not helping enough people. So what we decided was we should write the book. And the book is explicitly pro-parent because we want to, in a way, I've written quite a few parenting books and mental health books, and I believe that really in the last 30 years, a lot of, frankly, I'm a little bit guilty of it myself because I've written parenting books, but there's been a kind of a gradual disempowerment of parents, and parents turn to professionals very fast, especially if their teenager is distressed, a kind of professionalization of parents, of parenting. And what we wanted to do was kind of appreciate and acknowledge the fact that parents are generally the world expert on their kids. Parents generally, not always, there's always exceptions, love their kids more than anybody else and care about their kids and will think the long game for their kids in a way that a therapist in an office isn't necessarily thinking of. And so we wanted to kind of center the parents back into their own families as the authority, and to give them the kind of information so that they could, for example, make decisions according to their own values and not necessarily believe that a fast track or a medicalized approach to a gender identity, which has never really been tried before, so it's got no long-term evidence, not among adolescents, it hasn't been tried before. Like we're 10 years into it or so, that therefore maybe a slower, more cautious approach might be more appropriate. Certainly, just to finish, I would say that we're most conservative and cautious about the things we're most precious about. The things we love most in the world is where we go most carefully and slowly, and that's our children. And so we wrote a book that was very much centering the parent and saying, you know what, you can do it your way, and not necessarily our way, your way.
Yeah. I want to go back to the beginning, though, because I mentioned your story in the introduction. I'm not as familiar with your story. So if you allow me to be brazenly American and make you do that expose that those in the UK and Ireland don't like and get sheepish about, you know, you have had your own battles with this, as I read. I didn't read the book. I just did my research. Can you talk about how that experience obviously not only shaped your particular view on this, but shape you and your work in psychotherapy?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear it. I think we'd love to.
Yeah. You know, little did I know all these years later, I'd be talking about this, you know. So when I was a very young child, as far back as my memory goes, so around about 3 years old, I came to the conclusion I should be a boy, that I would be better as a boy, that it wasn't right that I was a girl. It didn't make sense that I was a girl. I was only three, so I was making sense of the world. I now know that there is a small cohort of children who are like me. And generally, when they are like me, and I was like this, the whole town knows about it. These kids are not self-conscious about it. They just bleat, I'm a boy, and you're going to call me. You know what I mean? As if I'm a boy.
In those days, it was called a tomboy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't even know. You probably can't even say that anymore, but it used to be.
Yeah, people don't use that word. I'd like to bring it back. Yeah, tomboy, because tomboy suited me because I had the word tom and boy in it. And there's no equivalent. It's very interesting that there's no equivalent for boys, if you follow me. There's no kind of Amy girl or Laura girl. Yeah. And now that I've studied it, I would say, yeah, that's true, because actually, if you look at the research, roughly about 80% of the kids like me who are effectively gender nonconforming, who seek to be the opposite sex, you know, at a very young age, end up being gay, lesbian or bisexual.
Yes.
And it's higher among the boys. And so in a homophobic society, which would have been really all the previous generations until almost this one, well, certainly the last couple, they would have been uneasy with these girly boys. You know what I mean? So tomboys are looked upon very affectionately because there isn't the presumption that they're going to be lesbians. It's like, they're just a tomboy. They'll grow out of it.
They're going to play ball with us and they're going to hang with us and they're not. but we also, as boys, don't like them physically in a way, yeah. right? It's a weird kind of gender nonconforming.
But the adults smile and they go, oh, isn't she feisty? And, you know, one day she'll grow up and be a swan. And there's a narrative. There's a lot in the literature. There's a lot of, you know, there's Jo March from Little Women. There's, you know what I mean? There's Pippi Longstocking. Yeah. There's lots in the literature that shows there was an affection for these feisty little girls who are often very assertive. There wasn't such affection for the feminine boys. It's never really had a place in society. We certainly don't have affectionate names for these boys. They've always been there running around saying, I'm a little girl, let me wear my dress. And they were, it's very interesting, they were the children that were brought to clinics, much more likely to be a boy that was brought to a clinic than a girl.
I wanted to interject here, even though I'm pushing ahead a little bit into your book. Yeah. One of the things I thought that you guys wrote about, which is very important because I'm sure you've gotten criticism unfairly for some of the things you've written, which is that you've told parents, and I'm just looking for the piece of it here, but you basically have told parents that let the kid boy play with dolls, let the girl be a tomboy, essentially. You're not telling them to stifle the identity. It's interesting. It made me think of the craziness we have. I live in California, which is truly insane in its politics, in terms of its leftism. And thankfully, because it was so politically unpopular, our governor, Gavin Newsom, vetoed a bill about gender neutral toy stores. About he's letting it go through, but he didn't sign the bill. It's complicated. But the idea that we're not going to have boys, if a big box retailer, Target or one of those, comes here, we're not going to call a boy and girl. We're just going to make it gender neutral. I mean, as opposed to, right, a parent, like you advise, I would do to my kids. Just let the kid, you don't need to get rid of gender. Let the boy go play with a Barbie. That's all you have to do.
Yeah. Well, maybe Gavin Newsom needs to learn a little bit about child development because it's well established that between about 3 and 7, the children are learning about roles and sex roles. So these small number like I was, and I'll go back to my story in a minute, they've kind of figured out, and they become like 1950s kind of stereotypes. Boys do this, girls do that. Do you know what I mean? For a little while. And there's a small number who go, no, I want to be over with the boys, or the, you know what I mean, the opposite. But they become very old-fashioned, almost stereotypical about, you know, the girl will be there doing the kind of the mommy roles and what she perceives as the mommy roles and stuff. It's just a developmental kind of stage that they go through. I went through it and I look back now, I've only got hindsight, so I might be adding arms and legs to this that aren't necessarily true. But all these years later, looking back, I often think I was an internal misogynist. I really didn't think much of girls. I thought that girlish was an insult. I thought prissy, irritating, squealy girls. I didn't like women either. Men and boys were where I was at. So it's kind of interesting. Yeah. When I look back, I remember I fundamentally disliked anything to do with girlishness. Intensely. But that lasted for many, many years with me. It was in the kind of 70s and 80s in Dublin. So nobody was bringing me to a psychiatrist to get a diagnosis. I was considered an eccentric kid just because I was very intense about it. I was very over the top. I now realize I'm very intense about everything. So some kids, rather than I had extreme gender dysphoria, I'm like, I'm very intense. And some of these kids are very intense. Is that necessarily their gender dysphoria, or is it their personality? It's kind of an interesting point. You know, a more gentle person mightn't have pushed it so much, but I certainly did. By the time puberty rolled around many years later, I had kind of got myself into a corner because everybody knew me as this tomboy. Everywhere I went, people say, are you a boy or a girl? And I'd kind of answer things like no, or boy, or I didn't really know what I was doing. I was all over the place. And puberty actually ended up being very difficult for me. It was harrowing. I was very lonely. I didn't know what to do. I realized that nature was bigger than me. I came to an extraordinary reckoning with my body and myself, realizing I kind of thought in a very childish, magical thinking kind of way that if I convince everybody I'm a boy, I'll be a boy. Now, that's classic six-year-old, seven-year-old conceptualization.
Yes.
Then you get to 8, 9, and 10, and you realize they're kind of pandering to me, and this is actually mortifying. You follow me? And then there's puberty.
That's an interesting point, though, because I was born in 1974, so.
Me too.
So I'm 50 this year. Happy birthday if you already are. I you didn't have the option, right? You weren't stifled. This is your experience. You didn't have the option to go to a clinic and completely become a boy anatomically, or at least attempt to. And that's goes to the heart of your book, but go on.
That's psychologically and conceptually massive. Nobody said you could be a boy. I was basically left to it, you know what I mean, which was very difficult. I'm not saying it wasn't, it was very difficult, but I was never given an option of you could stop puberty, because puberty was causing me all the trouble. Puberty was really, really, really difficult for me. Horrible time. However, with puberty, between the ages of roughly 10 and 20, comes a sexual awakening. With the sexual awakening comes an interest beyond yourself to other people. If you follow me, you start to have crushes, you start to fall in love, you start to up your social skills. And I kind of came to a kind of a social awareness of, well, I'd want to kind of sort out the way I look and the way I present if anybody's going to ever fancy me, if you follow me. So that was a kind of shocking, horrific dawning for me when I realized I'm in a corner and I need to get out of it because nobody's going to fancy me the way I am. And now I'm kind of not stereotypical, because I didn't end up becoming lesbian, but a lot of girls who would have been like me would become lesbian. And that would add to their feeling of maybe I'm just a boy, because they're thinking I fancy women. You know what I mean? Things like that. But that didn't happen to me. Anyway, life rolled on. I became comfortable in my own skin. I became comfortable that I was a woman. I ended up getting married and I had children, and having children is the most important part of my life. And then years later, when I was in my 30s, I studied to become a psychotherapist, went on, wrote about mental health, wrote some books about parenting and mental health and teenagers, because I have a special soft spot for teenagers. I think I had such a hard time myself. And then right up until I think I was 40, I don't know when I was, 45 or something, when I first started commenting about, it was about 8 years ago or something, I started commenting about gender, saying, well, actually, I had those experiences as a kid and trans was coming in as an issue. And all I was doing was kind of adding my voice, saying, well, I did have those issues and I resolved them. And between the time of me being a young child, then becoming into puberty where it was so difficult, ultimately resolving my issues and rolling on to become an integrated woman, I think whenever I did meet trans people, and I did obviously meet trans people along the way, I would always look at them kind of with a genuine, they would resonate with me, but I think that they got stuck and I didn't, if you follow me, that they got stuck in that identity and I didn't, for whatever reason. That reason, I don't know. Why does one person get stuck in something and one person doesn't? Now, people who believe in gender identity would believe that there's a soul effectively in you. There's some sort of gender identity within you. And if there's a mismatch, you should medicalize. And those people who transition have a different gender identity than their body. People like me have a different understanding of it. And we would say that we've had a developmental model of understanding, i.e., when you go through any sort of difficult challenge in life, you can kind of find a coping mechanism that might make you feel better. For example, some people might stop eating because it makes them feel powerful. Some other people might start tapping or washing their hands as a way to gain control of their life. There's lots of coping mechanisms there are. And one of them could be to be a different sex, to identify out of your own sex, or even identify as non-binary. In a way, it's almost the most alluring concept ever, that you could be a different person with a different name, with a different personality and a different body. We've never before had that option. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. And these days, children and teenagers are told, you could be somebody different. Would you like to create this other person, this persona? And the extraordinary kind of meeting of the digital world with this idea that you could be a different person.
Real rise of the iPhone in its potency was really a decade ago. And that is completely coinciding.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So the extraordinary rise in the iPhone is almost matched with the extraordinary rise in trans. So that's kind of very interesting. High-speed Wi-Fi, social media, all of those graphs are incredibly similar to each other. And
I like the book where you reference The Social Dilemma, that Netflix documentary, and basically say, you and your co-authors say, you know, you might want to check your algorithm rather than check into a puberty blocker clinic. You didn't say quite like that, but that's how I read it. No, because you want to look, and your parents should look and say, what are their kids seeing? Yeah. Oh my God, I'm really miserable. I just saw four people on TikTok and they're miserable. They went to a clinic, so I should too, which is, by the way, take the whole debate about identity and individuation, gender out of it. That is a preposterous way to parent. Okay, honey, let me take you. I mean, you're not going for vanilla ice cream. You're going for a life-changing moment.
Well, in fairness, I think what's happened on TikTok around diagnosis and mental illness is actually quite frightening. It's not just gender. It's not at all just gender. There's an awful lot of online self-diagnosis. There's an awful lot of kind of glamorization of mental illness, glamorization of self-harming behavior. If you were a parent and if you went and pretended to be a 12-year-old child and start your TikTok account, and I advise parents to do it, you will be astonished how soon self-harming, medical kind of pseudo-medical illness, pseudo-kind of psychiatric kind of disorders will be just appearing on your timeline. And you'll be thinking, that's not even called for. I'm not even looking for it. And it's arriving because it's so common. Among them, trans issues has become huge. So it is definitely an issue. It's very much a sense of belonging. There's a sense of belonging in the community, the LGBTQ community. And it's also a sense of belonging specifically for people who don't feel like other people. Now, you could say that's everybody. But there's some of us who just don't feel like we belong. And the LGBTQ community is particularly welcoming to them, which is lovely.
Yeah.
But I don't think you should need to medicalize. I think we discuss it in the book, and you know, my organization, GenSpec, very much kind of runs with this, that puberty blockers is a very extraordinarily authoritarian, high-handed intervention because it stops the sexual awakening of the young person. We've never done this before. Mm-hmm. And so the child is immediately out of sync with all their peers. All the peers are having, first of all, crushes on unattainable people, then crushes on real life people, then starting to maybe go out with people and, you know, maybe the first kiss and all that. People who are blocked with their puberty, young people, they're not getting any sexual awakening. There's no yearning to be with anybody else.
I want to outline too, this is important to your point, you know, the sort of two camps, because this debate has become so binary. It's what your book is trying to wade through the thicket of, okay? There's the first category, the affirmation camp, which you guys talk about. You know, there's no shortage of TikToks and books and materials and summer camps, highly profitable clinics, as you guys write, television shows to push children toward that. But then on the other hand, there's this sort of, as you lay out, consideration often vilified, right? Because for parents who express alarm or people who are like, oh, wait a second, I'm not sure, of a view that says, wait a second, let's slow down. And the media and a lot of its champions, certainly on the left, I think even on the center left, sadly, you know, are shout at you and say, if you deprive, you know, trans presenting children of a medical option, they become suicidal. Doctors are pressuring parents to do it, and parents feel they have nowhere to turn because they want to support their kids, understandably, and I think they should, as your book is clear about, but they feel pressured into making a very hasty medical decision, not grounded in enough research yet. Well, why are we there? In other words... Well, in other words, and I know this is like the sort of existential issue, but why is it that if a kid is told that they can't transition, we go right to being told they're suicidal? A, is that true? I mean, it just seems, why? I mean, that seems so, and I know there's a lot to unpack. I again, my audience says I'm a gay man. I'm deeply sympathetic to marginalized communities. I get it, but we've lost the damn plot. I mean, how do we get there? I just don't understand. That's why I wanted
I've studied this so extensively. I'm actually doing a PhD in it. I'm really, really involved in this way. Yeah. And I haven't figured out why this has exploded, but I have a couple of thoughts to make about it. Number one, it is people made an awful lot of, especially psychiatry and psychology, made an awful lot of mistakes with gay people in the past.
Yes.
And they were rejected. They were told they were disordered. They were told that they were sick. Right. And we as a community, we as a society, we're embarrassed about what happened. So it's almost like we've got an opportunity to atone for the bad behavior of previous generations with a kind of superlative celebration of a trans identity that they believe is very similar to being gay. Now, I don't see it as being similar to being gay, because if you're gay, lesbian, or bisexual, you don't stop sexual awakening. You don't medicalize anything. You don't impair the person's sexual functioning or their fertility. They are free to do as they wish and to fall in love with whoever they wish. You just do nothing. If somebody came to me and they said they think they're gay, I would just, you know, be very nice, but I have nothing to do. I don't have to jump in and get the ambulance or get doctors or, do you know what I mean? All I have to do, that's
right. You're an antidote to antiquarian thinking that said it was a disorder. It's an accepting thing. You love yourself, love people of the same gender, and then counsel them through their emotional journey, but nothing to do with the politics of it.
So equally, if somebody came to me and said, and they were young, and they said they were trans, I could say, there's nothing I need to do. I would counsel them on their emotional journey, but I don't need to do anything, if you follow me. Let them find themselves would be where I would come from. Let them. However, medicalizing it is jumping many steps ahead very fast, I would argue. So to the reason why people seek to medicalize it is purportedly because they believe there's a suicide risk. But the suicide risk has been studied. You remember I said 10 years ago there was no research, we just didn't know. Yeah. And people talked about suicide risk, but there was no research. Thankfully, now we actually have very strong research because it's been followed. So what they did was they followed the biggest gender identity clinic for children in the world, which was JIDS at the Tavistock in the UK. They followed it over a course of 10 years, 2010 to 2020. And over those 10 years, there was 15,000 children both being seen and on the waiting list. So in its entirety, 15,000 children. And of those 15,000, four children were known or suspected to have died by suicide. So 4 out of 15,000 isn't much higher than any children with mental health issues, if you follow me.
So anxiety. I also wanted to buttress your point for a second. I followed closely the report from Tavistock, which I know they shut down, right? The BBC did a really extensive analysis. They're no right-wing group. And what's the reporter's name?
Hannah Barnes.
Yes, and the thing that she spoke about, really, which was really the core of it, is that the sense of shame that many young people feel, especially boys, but not all, about being bisexual, right, got transmuted into this idea that they might be needed gender-affirming surgery, they might be trans, they might be non-binary. A lot of it had to do with the gay shame you're talking about, the sort of internalized homophobia. Therefore, right, the logic went, I'm ashamed of myself and I'm a boy. If I become a girl, right, then I can be with a boy and I'm heterosexual.
I'm straight.
I thought it was very interesting because then I don't know, I'm sure Hannah got pilloried and BBC got pilloried, but it seemed like an incredibly thorough analysis and it seems to dovetail with your research.
Yeah, there's a very strong disproportionate number of young adolescents who are gay, lesbian, or bisexual. They first come out as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, and then they come out as trans. As in, I tried being it and I felt uncomfortable. Because I have to say that coming out as gay, you are declaring your sexual, you know, tendency, your preference. None of us who are heterosexual, we don't have to come out. It's a big thing, you know what I mean? To suddenly say, if I had to say at 13 what I like sexually, or 15, oh my God, can I not?
And I think discussions of sexuality and gender get terribly muddled and full of not just misinformation, but myth. So I give an example. Yeah. I've been out since I'm 20. And one of the things you learn when you come out young, and I came out in the 90s, so I've been doing it a long time now, is how many guys I've met who are bisexual or who are gay and don't have an acceptance. Some are absolutely bi. They like both. Some are experimenting, and others are going to be gay. They're on the road, you know. Used to be an old joke, oh, buy now, gay later. I don't know if you ever heard that. And I would, you know, date many of them and whatever. They might have been full of confusion or whatever. But the difference is that fluidity in sexuality is as old as time. Okay, the Greeks, the Romans, this isn't new. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, and social justice warriors, to everything to them, because there's a terrible narcissism. Every idea is new. We're championing the idea. Oh, yeah. I mean, young kids on Instagram DM me and tell me I'm not woke enough. And I've told them who I am and what I did. And, oh, I didn't know you came out. Oh, I didn't know you came out. Then you don't know anything. You watch social media and you talk the same way you don't know history about anything. You make things up based on emotion or social contagion, right? So my point in saying this is all is that gender and sexuality are two different things. And this is does not mean that there aren't real people who are trans and they deserve our respect and dignity. They do. It's a big choice, a big part of their identity that after 18, they can decide if they want to have any kind of physical alterations or changes or surgeries. But I have never woken up a day in my life and felt like I'm not a man. I'm still a man. I'm just a man who's attracted to men. So I don't have that journey. It's a very different journey. But I also don't have the belief that many activists do as a gay man that everybody's secretly gay. You know, the gay rights movement's goal was not to make everybody gay. It was for dignity under the law. You know, I think there's a segment of trans activists that those are the people that upset me the most, who insist that gender doesn't exist and that the notion of it is preposterous and biology is not real. And it's like, okay, guys, you're just an anti-science group of cranks. That's all. You might be struggling. You might have your own stuff, but don't tell me, because if gender is not real and now that's not real, then I'm not a man who likes men. I mean, that now you're taking away my identity. I am in support of everybody's identity, but you do you and stop the proselytizing. That's my issue with that segment of the community.
I couldn't agree more. Like, you do you and let me do me and let us all each do each other. But to go back to
liberation, all of a sudden now we have police in the name of, you know, they're cops in the name of liberty. It's like, give me a break.
But to go back to the gay point, imagine if when a child came out as gay or lesbian, that they immediately medicalized it and concretized it. It would be like, whoa, 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 slow down. You know what I mean? They're 12, if you follow me. There's a lot of growing to do.
Yes, I had girlfriends, a very serious girlfriend in high school, and when I dated girls, and that's right. There were parts of me I didn't know. There were parts I remember as a younger kid feeling, and then there were times as a teenager I felt very inclined to women. I didn't know. So I'm glad there was no medical procedure. I absolutely ended up being gay, but I'm glad I got to explore. And by the way, for the guys in my life who I've known who explore men and women on a regular, great. That's just fluidity. That's human. It doesn't require law or fiat or social contagion to figure out. It's just who they are, you know?
So we'd be very pro, like, do whatever you want, wear whatever you want, wear makeup, you know, run around with jewelry, wear a dress, do whatever you want.
Let a boy play with the doll if they want, of course.
But you just don't, to medicalize your identity, to stop your sexual awakening, to go into a limbo for some years, and then to start again with a synthetic chemical puberty of the opposite sex is a pretty radical intervention that should have a heavy body of science behind it. And it doesn't exist. There is no long-term body of science.
This is a largely American audience we're speaking to, which is the reason I'm bringing you on. Is the other thing we have to know, I'm gonna read a little bit of this NHS puberty blocker news. The America is something of an outlier in this, is it not? There's sort of like the scientific community and the sort of liberal bent of it now, as I have been following it, and you can correct me and fill in details, seems to say that we can't even really have a discussion over this. This is a Republican attack on trans people, so therefore we can't discuss it. Meanwhile, I know that Finland and Germany, and you're probably more familiar with the European countries, have brought these procedures into great question, if not outright banned puberty blockers or gender transitions under 18 for reasons. So for scientific reasons that don't exist, you know, for for reasons that are not scientifically grounded. So the NHS, has recently banned this stuff. And I just wonder, what's the what's going on in England? I'm just looking.
Okay. What's happened is, well, when you look at Europe first and then I'll go to England, you know, Sweden and Scandinavia were pretty much the pioneers of pediatric gender transition. They were Sweden and Scandinavia in general. They were the pioneers. They led the show, and they have pulled back. So Sweden has pulled back, Finland's pulled back, Norway's pulled back, Denmark's pulled back, France has pulled back, the UK has now recently pulled back. All of them were pro puberty blockers. They have now done systematic reviews, or they've done their studies of the cohorts that were blocking their puberty and then going on to the opposite sex puberty. And they've realized that actually the results are very inconclusive. There's no sufficient evidence to say this is a healthy, positive intervention. Instead, we've got an awful lot of distress and an awful lot of continued challenges. So it hasn't been the kind of the magic and a panacea for a better life. And on top of that, may I point out, there's been extraordinary rises in medical transition or puberty blockers among young people. So if you look at it in England, it was 4,000 and 5,000% among girls rise in the number of adolescents, because it was tiny numbers and then suddenly it was much higher. But there was no corresponding drop in suicide rates. So if you look at this over the last 10 years, it's like, well, if this was going to be, well, they will die by suicide, surely we would have prevented an awful lot of suicides with this skyrocketing numbers of people who are medically transitioning. But there was no impact. It didn't impact them at all. So that's just a kind of an added point around, you know, that this is nothing. This does not impact the suicide figures. It never was a high suicide risk. These are very distressed kids who do need a lot of care. I don't deny that. And I hope they all receive all the care that they need. I think we're living in a society where we're very prone to look for, you know, a pill for every ill. I think, honestly, the numbers of teenagers on SSRIs is frightening. The number of children on all sorts of medications, and gender is just one of the many medications they're starting to be. Medicalizing personalities, medicalizing their gender identities. We've never done it before. And how is it going? I would say not very well, because if SSRIs and Ritalin and Adderall were going to help the younger generations, we'd know it by now, because we've been doing it since the 1990s. We would know, you know what I mean? We would have the good results in. We're not getting good results. In fact, if you look at Jonathan Haidt's new book, The Anxious Generation.
Yeah, and that speaks about the iPhone room kids. Isn't that kind of the whole...
Yeah. Yeah. Not only the phone-based childhood, but it's also the frightening rates of depression and anxiety among this very overprescribed and overdiagnosed generation. They are not thriving as a result of it. But I've kind of lost the thread of what I was saying. But yeah, technically, just to go back to, so the NHS, which is England, Britain. Well, it's NHS.
I lived in London for 2 years and I loved everything about it. And I use the NHS regularly, obviously not for this, but I thought they were great. So I hope they...
That they have announced they're banning puberty blockers except in the case of clinical trials. The big flaw in this whole puberty blockers experiment was they never had control groups. So we do not know what would have happened had some of these kids been allowed to have puberty and some of them hadn't. Had they only done that, we would know. We'd have a comparison. We'd have an idea.
So but we don't. Sweden and Finland, all these places that are pulling back, which is, you know, America now being an outlier and sort of not the whole country, but in the way that medicine's treating it. Were the politics so radical there that they allowed all this to be pushed in a way without any scientific discussion in these countries? Is that what happened? Is that why they went as far as they did and pulled back? In other words, it's such a small, I guess the other thing to ask is such a small percentage of the community. And I want to make this clear, and your book does too. I'm advocating for the dignity of everybody, but we're also talking about science and real life changes. So how did an issue this small subsume medical evidence in a community in Europe like it did? And I know why, I know the sort of wokeness of it all here, but I know they're, to my question is, they're pulling back now. Why did it accelerate there?
Well, it accelerated because there was a theory. Again, I would go back to there was an equivalence between trans and gay, and people thought, oh, we've got gay part two and we'll do it right this time. This is my theory. I don't have evidence on that. But I believe, yeah, it is an interesting theory. But the second reason was in the Netherlands, which is where they brought in the experiment, they basically had a group of scientists who decided to try puberty blockers as an intervention for these gender nonconforming young people. They'd never tried it before. Puberty blockers were created for a very specific condition, which is called precocious puberty. And some very young children, we're talking 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old children, they go into a precocious puberty and they have to be blocked from it because it's not appropriate for a girl who's 5 to be getting grown breasts and having a period. So instead you block it. And then when they're 9 or 10, you stop taking the blockers and they go into their biological puberty. So that's what it was created for. And it was created in the 1980s. And a clinician in a Netherlands clinic was kind of very much exercised by the fact that the males who go through male puberty were having very, very serious difficulty if they transitioned in adult life to present as a woman because of their voice, because of their facial hair, because their Adam's apple and their masculinized body, they weren't able to pass. And so the clinicians thought, imagine if we blocked their puberty, they would pass much better. Now, the reason why the clinicians were examining this point was because the life of people who medically transitioned as adults wasn't, you know, statistically very happy. They have 19 times more likely to die by suicide, much more likely to be in a psychiatric hospital, much more likely to be, you know, in hospital and in prison. So it was a difficult life. So they thought, well, maybe it's because they're not passing as women. And so we need to block their puberty early and so that they will be able to pass as women. Okay, so that was the theory. But by the way, therefore, there was never any reason for girls because testosterone utterly masculinizes. So that wasn't an issue for girls. If I took my testosterone for a few years, I would look male. And they're very, very fast. And the male voice would come on me. But for men, it's not so easy to pass as women. And that's why they brought it in. It was a theory. And I think theories are worth examining. But they should have had a control group. They had 70 children. And they decided to block their puberty and follow them. And of those 70 children, 15 got knocked out of the study for reasons because of health complications such as diabetes and obesity and heart complications. That's worrisome already. And then of the 55 that were left out of the 70 original, one of them died as a result of medical transition, the genital surgery. One person died and the rest of them all went on to medicalize as adults. And that became the groundbreaking clinical study called the Dutch Protocol. And from that, it spread like wildfire. So it was kind of in and around 2011, the first results came, and then 2014, the second results came. And it just spread as a concept. And, you know, psychiatry and health in general, we love solutions. We love innovation. We love exciting new ideas. You know, when Prozac first came and the idea that, it's so exciting to think we have something, we have something new, and it's going to help a huge amount of people. And it's exciting and it's compelling and it's, you know what I mean? And I feel that we got wrapped up in the idea that we had a solution, a very radical solution. There's something very compelling about that. But it's a very small number of children. One of them died. Many of them pulled out. Some of the results are only for about 32 of these 70 kids originally. It's not a great study by anybody's measure. When you look at the COVID studies and stuff like that, they were much higher quality than this little study.
About a year ago, I don't remember, and there's been a few of them, but there was a big article in the New York Times about people who had detransitioned.
Oh, yeah.
You may have read it. You know, we can analyze it in the main, okay? What is going on with people detraining? You know, this is the subject no one wants to talk about. So we talk about it here, but we don't bullshit. So
good for you.
We just want to get to the, here's the thing. It might be an editorial, but I'm not going to lie to people. What about the number of people detransitioning? I feel like that news gets either buried or underreported. I mean, I was shocked the New York Times even did it, but of course it got pilloried for it. How many of these people who do this before they're 18 end up detransitioning? Do we know? Each is different, I know, but
That's the million-dollar question. The tragedy is we don't have numbers. We don't know how many are transitioning. We don't know how many are detransitioning. I know a few things, so I can tell you a few things. One thing I can start with, which is I started following D-Trans Reddit, and I urge everybody who's interested in this subject to go and follow.
D-Trans Reddit, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's a Reddit, subreddit. And of the, there was less than 1,000 members when I started following it in 2019. Now there's over 50,000 members. Now they're not all detransitioners, and the moderators have done quite a lot of surveys, and they say about 2/3 of the people are detransitioners. About 1/3 are people like me who are just interested in the subject. And so that's not scientific, but it's certainly an extraordinary rise in numbers. Then if you look at, there was a study by Lisa Lippman in 2022, which studied 100 detransitioners, and of that 100, 76% never informed the clinic that they had detransitioned. They see it as kind of returning to the scene of the attack. They feel very, very angry and very distressed, and they don't go near the clinics. And another piece of information to work with is that at GenSpec, the organization I founded and I'm the director, we have a service where we give funding for therapy for people who've been harmed by medical transition. We've got about 100 detransitioners on our books and we've got 200 detransitioners on our books, over 200, and about 100 therapists. And so we are kind of very much working with these groups. And we find that again and again and again, they feel silenced, they feel vilified. They are the minority within the minority, and people don't want hear their story. It's a really sad story because they thought they should medically transition. They might get a mastectomy. They might have facial hair, a man's voice, maybe hair on their chest and on their back and their bum. And then they realize, actually, I was a lesbian all along. I shouldn't have medically transitioned. And then they try to reverse the process, but they don't have breasts. They have a masculinized presentation, and it's very difficult to return.
So there's 22 states roughly, because there's still some legislation making its way through legislatures across America that ban gender affirming surgery. They're mainly red states, as we call them, or Republican states, not all, but mainly. And those states have been vilified as bigoted, hateful places. Now, to be clear, okay, because I'm not a member of either party, there are a lot of bad faith actors in this debate. There are plenty of people who opposed gay civil rights for years that now have a new boogeyman. All of that being said, good faith, bad faith arguments do inform everything from any debate, especially the trans debate, women in sports, all this stuff, because people want to come at it as a fear monger or from a hateful position. But putting that aside, given that we don't have enough evidence, and you know, your book astutely advises parents to just really think about the children and let it be a parental decision. Do you think that these American states are right in codifying into law bans? I want to get into the politics of this now here and abroad.
Yeah. I'm very worried about how America has gone at transition and gender in general. I think they're in quite severe danger of going the way that they went with gun laws and abortion laws.
Whoops. What is that? Maybe phone. I don't think
is that my phone.
Could be.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I can't see where it is.
I don't know. Maybe.
Hang on a second.
That's all right. Take your time.
I don't know where it's the ringing is coming from.
Somebody wants you.
Yeah, but I wonder.
Gotta be. Is it a? You have a landline?
No, it's like it's coming from the computer, but I can't see it.
It's almost like it's an alarm.
Oh yeah, it is kind of like that.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
It's all right. Is it a phone alarm or maybe something?
Oh, it's gone. I wonder what that was.
No worries. No worries.
Okay.
We roll here at the dirty.
Yeah. Moderate. I hope it doesn't come back though. I wonder where my phone is, because usually I'd have my phone handy, and I don't seem to have it. Well, I keep going anyway. We're presumably towards the end.
Yes.
So to go back to that point, I'll say this again. I hope it doesn't happen again, because it just is coming from like
America with gun laws and abortion. In what way? Can you be more specific? What do you mean?
I fear, I'm worried about America because I fear that trans issues are going to go the way of gun laws and abortion issues, which is a red light, red, white. I'll start again. I fear for America in many ways because I fear that that America is going the way with trans issues and gender issues, the way they've gone with abortion issues and gun laws, which is it's become a red blue divide. It's become, you know, red state, blue state. It's become your pro or anti. It's very loads of lack of nuance. It's one or the other, black, white, yes, no. And there's no room for, well, hang on, could we perhaps discuss this? Might there be a middle ground? It feels very familiar and it feels very frighteningly divisive and polarized. Yes. And, you know, I don't think the same has happened in Europe. And so they're pulling back on puberty blockers. But it doesn't feel like this is a devastating win for the right or something like that. It's not being framed like that. It's been framed as hospitals have reviewed the evidence. They don't see sufficient evidence to stop puberty. And so they've stopped giving puberty blockers and off we go. But this reframing of it into a red-blue issue, banning kind of all sorts of every kind of aspect of it. What we want to do in Genspect, and we do have a Genspect USA branch and it's thriving, we want to, for example, have insurance companies meet the responsibilities. So if they insure medical transition, they need to also insure the secondary complications related to medical transition. And they also need to insure detransition. A lot of people who detransition or who have complications, they're not insured to deal with the fact that they have these complications. And so we believe insurance companies need to properly insure medical transition if they're going to insure it, rather than this like kind of outright bans on everything feels. Some of them might be great. I don't know. Like you said, 30 odd states. Some of them could be brilliant.
Well, I think you're absolutely right from afar. And again, as I said, I spend a little bit of time living abroad, but you watch America slip into its own worst polarized setup. You know, I've been doing a lot of it now. My podcast was created to be for democracy and be able to nuance issues and not be beholden. I'm on the red team, I'm on the blue team, and you're absolutely right. That is where our politics is, and this becomes affiliated with this. I mean, every debate now becomes, well, you can't vote for a Republican because they hate trans people, or you can't vote for a Democrat because they believe in open borders. You know, everything becomes that, of course, amplified by social media. But again, speaking to a very specific thing, I think abortion and guns is a very good example where I'm pro-choice, but, you know, Roe v. Wade had restrictions in the second trimester. Now we're in this, because it was overturned, we're having a debate about everything is a drop-dead issue that is deeply affecting women. That's real. But, you know, that we've certainly lost nuance to any degree in that debate. And on the gun debate, and we've done that here, you know, I believe in the Second Amendment. Okay, 99% of Americans do, and excuse me, 95% of gun owners do, and they're not out there killing the people in school. They're just not. They're hunters, and it's not true. But the people that do get the press, and also laws sometimes get passed. And I did a whole thing with someone who's working with the NRA and gun control people, and I tend to favor gun safety, even though I favor guns, passing laws that won't do anything to stop gun violence. So then it becomes, well, if you're against that law, right, then you're a horrible monster. You know, it's like, okay, well, that law isn't a good law. You know, similar to, you know, well, I think if the science isn't settled, I'm just philosophizing, you know, postulating. The science isn't settled, well, maybe we shouldn't have gender-affirming surgery. You transphobic pig. You know, and that is what we cut through the thicket here. And by the way, that's what most Americans are so tired of, you know. And this debate, I think, illuminates our best and worst instincts.
Yeah, and that's what I meant. I'm not taking a position on abortion or gun laws.
I'm not asking. No,
it's the polarized lack of nuance. You're for or against? Which are you? Decide now. And it's like, can we have maybe a conversation? talking Listen, about
I'm in the 75%, though I'm such an anti-Trump person, but I'm in the 75% of people who don't want this rematch. I mean, you're in Ireland watching the United States pit Joe Biden against Donald Trump. I'm sure you grew up, oh, I shouldn't speak for you. A lot of people abroad grew up with a certain reference for the United States as a superpower and what we did. Yeah. I mean, is this particularly exciting to the Irish? I'm
looking on just I'm astonished that it's going to be Trump versus Biden again. I'm literally I can't because, you know, when Trump first got in, effectively, the Democrats then had 4 years to kind of regroup and organize themselves to have a good option. Right. Then Biden got in and the Republicans had a, you know, 4 years to regroup. And yet they haven't come up with anybody new. It's an astonishing, and it does feel like maybe money has created a situation where the actual options of who can be president has become really, really small. Something yes. about the system seems broken that it's going to be Biden versus Trump. It just seems wrong. From over here, it just seems like that's not working.
Oh, no, absolutely. And to close out this wonderful conversation and to related to this point, this campaign, okay, when it relates to trans issues, is going to be you're on Biden, you're pro-trans, you're with Trump, you're anti-trans, there won't be anything in between. And that leads me to my sort of final question is, and not about Trump-Biden, but with this, the issue of what you're working for, what your book says, what Jen Speck is doing, please tell everybody what you would like. Okay, I want people to read this book. When kids say they're trans, you should follow Stella O'Malley. We're going to get your socials in a second. But again, to free ourselves from the shackles of childish politics and name calling and idiocy, just encapsulate, right, how to best nuance a debate that requires it. So people, non-parents, that kind of thing.
Right. We want both from our book, you know, when kids say they're trans, and also from Jen Specht and from myself as a psychotherapist. What we want is an acknowledgement that better outcomes happen as a result of civilized, well thought out, informed discussion.
Right.
And if we can have discussion of any given treatment approach, condition, identity, or any of the above and all, if we can just discuss it, we will come to better outcomes. And so we're advocating, you know, within GenSpect, a healthy approach to sex and gender, as in it's healthy to discuss. It's healthy to discuss pros and cons, you know, the good and the bad. Make sure that we include all the different kind of people's stories. And then in our book, when kids say they're trans, it's like, yeah, let parents be the parent of their child fundamentally. Most parents really, really care about their children. Give parents back their authority to be an authority on their children's lives. There's been a kind of a creeping kind of lack of respect for parents and also presumption that the parents are hurting their children. And I'm like, well, the experts, and I include myself as a psychotherapist, we haven't covered ourselves in glory in history. We're not that great. And as I said earlier, if Ritalin and Adderall and all that was going to cure and help the younger generation, we would know it. The results are not good. We're in a generation of young people now who seem to be really crippled by mental health issues. And I don't know why that is, but I do think it merits a lot of free and informed and civilized discussion.
No, amen. And again, the book is When Kids Say They're Trans. Stella O'Malley co-wrote it with Sasha Ayad and Lisa Marciano. She is a psychotherapist who works on these issues and many more, runs an organization called Jen Specht, as I mentioned in the introduction. Where can people find you? Are you on X, Twitter? Are you anywhere to be found? I'm sure you are.
I'm on X. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram at Stella O'Malley. Jen Specht is also on all that. And also we have a podcast called Gender Wider Lens if people want to hear more. We've hundreds of episodes, myself and Sasha.
What's your Twitter handle? Sorry, your
X. Oh, Stella O'Malley. Stella O'Malley 3, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Stella, I want everybody to know. Stella, I really appreciate this conversation. You know, it's exactly what we do, finding that middle lane and having nuance for a very important subject. And again, needless to say, the kids are not all right. They need all the help they can get. And we need experts to be willing to be humble and open and you know, not propagandize. Just tell people what it is and let parents make these decisions. I think they're for a limited government guy, I like that the most. Not the government, not the institutions, not all the experts who are not covered in glory, as you say, who love their children. Stella, thank you for joining the show. As for the rest of us, what do I always tell you? Stay dirty, stay moderate, and stay safe.
Thank you very much.